Radio WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on a big program, we're going to be talking with Ulrich Boser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, about education. How's the money being spent? What's the best way to do that? Vouchers, is this the way to go? I'm not so sure. So the interesting conversation there. Colleen Stevens is going to be here talking about the drywall. You remember talking about the drywall that we brought in after the hurricanes, after the levees broke in Louisiana? We brought all this Chinese drywall in, fixed up places. Turns out it's rotten, and it's made with the worst possible stuff, making people sick, and it all has to be gutted and redone again. The question then becomes, who's inspecting the stuff coming in from China? This woman actually is living through this nightmare. Imagine if you do have redone your entire house and you got to rip all the drywall out because we didn't bother to check that. Sorry, whoops, missed it. Mark Steer from Penn Action is going to be here talking about the healthcare bill, and Mike Fedor, candidate for Cumberland County Commissioner, going to come talk to us a little bit about his run. It happened. The Republicans have held up their end of the bargain. And I know all the tax-paying folks in the listening area are just thrilled to death. Absolutely thrilled that we have wasted another day paying our Congress to just spew platitudes, to regurgitate pointless right-wing talking points. And my question in all of this is, where are the right-wing blowhard budget hawks? Where are these folks? Because I'm missing the point. You spent an entire 2 days saying what you said during the campaign. There was no debate. There was no discussion. All we did is throw out talking points. All you heard was the Republicans saying the same things over and over and over. It's going to increase spending, even though the numbers show otherwise. It's going to increase taxes. Well, not so much. It's going to destroy jobs. I mean, it's in the name. The repealing the job-killing health care law act. Job-killing. I love the one guy. He, Republican Representative Jeff Duncan. It's time we return this house to the people. And we can start by repealing this job-killing, socialistic, out-of-touch health care bill. Yet most people now starting to see some of the, and maybe Pelosi was right. As much as I was just pained to hear her say, as the American people find out what's in this, they're going to like it. Because it does change things. It does protect people. It does help the uninsured. Maybe she was right, because the numbers are coming down. the number of people who want to see this repealed going down. And I was watching C-SPAN, and you listen to the comments while they're voting. And, of course, the vote passed, 245 to 189. Three Democrats jumped over to vote against this, which, you know, pretty surprising. But one guy said something that just grabbed me. And again, it's your talk radio talking point. Yeah, well, you know, the Democrats are pointing out 8 or 9 things that are good. Yeah, those 8 or 9 things are good. So we should just throw away the other 2,300 pages, he said. And it's this very simplistic mindset that you can have one page for one good thing, and everything is related to one issue. And I guess it really goes into how we think laws are made. Because this bill, well, again, I've said it before a number of times, not entirely thrilled with it, it's a starting point, is a step in the right direction. And I would have thought that this day would have been better spent, since the Republicans want quality access for everyone. They want affordable, lower costs. You know, I don't know how many times I heard we need to lower costs without any specific how we're going to go about that. You know, Republican friends and, you know, the three Democrats, if you've got a way to lower costs, we should be hearing about it. If you've got that magic bullet to bring those costs down, because you didn't do it for years. During the entire Bush administration, while healthcare costs were spiraling out of control, and if we repeal this, are going to completely skyrocket out of control, why didn't you do anything with this magic bullet that you had then? To lower costs and to increase access? Because that's all they kept saying. Well, we need to repeal this so we can lower costs and increase access. Hasn't happened. This bill, and like I said, not entirely thrilled with it, but it is a step in the right direction. It does begin to look at costs. It does ensure access, does away with pre-existing conditions, does away with rescission. And look, the majority of it doesn't happen for another 3 years. But we're talking about doing away with it before it even has a chance to start. And this from the party who's against abortion. Interesting stuff. But, you know, I kept hearing the Republican talking point. And this grabbed me, and I kept thinking about it. They kept saying that the job-killing health care act would cost us 650,000 jobs if we don't repeal this job-killing bill. Now, remember, this is their softer language. This is them being toned down. And it's funny because you could, when they got into the heat of the moment, they started off with, you know, the job-destroying bill. And as they got heated up, it went back to the old rhetoric. Oh, socialistic job killers! Which this is not. Not at all. But they kept throwing out this number, 650,000 jobs. The country is going to lose 650,000 jobs because of Obama's socialistic health care. And, you know, I kept going, where'd they get this? And evidently they got it from a CBO report, Congressional Budget Office report, that says that let me read it to you. This is right from the report. It says the legislation on net will reduce the amount of labor used in the economy by a small amount, roughly half a 1%, primarily by reducing the amount of labor that workers choose to supply. This is what their budget numbers, their budget crunchers said. Now, what the Republicans heard is the CBO has determined that the law will reduce the amount of labor used in the economy by roughly half of a percent. An estimate adds up to roughly 650,000 jobs lost. So that's how the Republicans heard it. So basically, again, cutting out all of the thought that goes into this and just taking the simplistic point, half a percent. All the jobs in the economy equals 650,000 jobs. So I guess we're going to lose 650,000 jobs, according to the CBO. Now, understand, the CBO made this caveat. They said, look, people are going to choose to work less. People are going to withhold their labor. The guy I met out in the parking lot when we were doing our food drive, who was hanging on, working three jobs, working just getting what he can so that he can get insurance. until he can get onto Medicare, he's going to leave the workforce. We know that. Now, him leaving the workforce, and think about this for a second. This guy who is, you know, just hanging on by the skin of his teeth until he can get to Medicare, taking up three jobs just to try and make it. Are we going to lose those jobs because he gets out of the workforce? That's what they're trying to say. They're trying to say by this guy deciding, you know what? I can get health care from the federal government or through a state plan. So I'm going to leave the workforce. Somehow this equates into job loss. Personally, I think it's a good idea. Personally, I think those people who are in their late 50s, early 60s, who are going, you know what? Man, I can't afford not to hold on and hang on and do what I got to do till I get to Medicare. I think this is a good idea. We got a major unemployment problem in this country. I don't know if you've noticed. 15-some million people unemployed. This might not be a bad thing to say, well, you know what? Maybe we can lose those people in the job, in the workforce, so we can let younger workers take those jobs. And as I've said, you know, once we take health care off the backs of people, then you will see the entrepreneurial spirit. People going, you know what? I can go forge out on my own because I don't have to worry about my children getting sick. I can open up my own business. I can put out my own shingle because I don't have to worry about my wife or my children or myself for that matter. So I look at this, and again, it's another one of these, you know, what do they say? Figures lie and liars figure. This is another one of those moments where they, here's part of the fact, the part we want you to see, and them using it again in a really a disingenuous way. But are we surprised? And this idea, and they kept throwing it out, this idea that somehow the employers were going to bear the brunt of the cost, to me seems kind of ridiculous. Because it's the employee who's going to ultimately pay the cost through lower wages. Now, the companies that are doing the right thing and getting their employees health care, they're going to be all right because they're already doing the right thing. This is just making sure everybody else comes up. This isn't pulling people down. And that's the thing that I think is important here. This isn't mandating that people come down to a certain level. This is mandating that some people come up. Now, are you going to have people who have really, really good health care that they might lose some of it? I think that's probably going to happen. But at the end of it, costs are going to come down because we're covering everybody. But, you know, it's one of those things. And this vote today to me was an entire waste of 2 days, a waste of millions of dollars of taxpayer money when we have real problems that need to be dealt with, jobs that need to be created. But we needed to score these political points. And that's all this was about. Understand that. They know this isn't going anywhere. They know that they got their moment in the sun. They got their names plastered across the headlines, and tomorrow you'll see it. Big win for the Republicans. But it's not going anywhere. The Senate's not going to pick it up because it doesn't have a chance of passing. And the president would veto it. It's not got a chance of passing. What I'm saying, what we should be doing, maybe take a couple of minutes and work on how to make it better. If you've got ideas how to lower costs, I want to hear it. If you've got ideas how to improve access, want to hear it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you've got an idea, thought, comment. When we come back, I'm going to talk with Ulrich Boser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, about the school issue. We're right back after this. We want the world.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Auto Workers helped announce Tuesday that Ford is investing $400 million in its Kansas City assembly plant over the next 2 years.
That factory will produce a new line of next-generation vehicles. It currently produces the Ford F-150 pickup and Ford Escape. The UAW says the investment will secure thousands of direct and supporting jobs in the Kansas City area. UAW Vice President Jimmy Settles says the union is pleased to have the cooperation of labor, business, and government working together to retain good jobs in Missouri. UE's Chris Townsend says workers at the Taunton, Massachusetts, Esterline Technologies Haskin plant are considering an improved severance offer. The UE Local 204 Executive Board is recommending the workers accept the deal, and they'll vote on it later this week. So the planned action to try and stop an auction of the plant's equipment Wednesday has been called off.
I'll never second-guess our local members. I think that they battled this thing out to the 25th hour, did the very best they could with all of the heavy artillery pointed at them. For anyone even imagining what it might be like to be in the shoes of somebody in this situation, some folks presumably who are listening have been through this, is that there's an absolutely natural, reasonable tendency to look a little more fondly on the bird in the hand as opposed to the very sketchy or promissory bird in the bush.
Minneapolis Jimmy John's workers will get another chance at electing to join the IWW after losing by just 2 votes in an election nullified because the company violated labor law. Jesse Russell reports.
An attempt to organize nearly 200 workers for Jimmy John's sandwich shops in Minneapolis has been anything but freakishly fast. The Industrial Workers of the World won the right for a union election on October 22nd. And lost by a vote of 87-85. However, the IWW alleged to the National Labor Relations Board that the company had engaged in unlawful union busing tactics. The union alleged that Jimmy John's threatened to freeze wages and to retaliate against union supporters. On January 10th, the NLRB ruled in favor of the union and nullified the election. After 60 days, the IWW will be allowed to file for a new election. As the union works toward a new election, workers are asking the company's owners to take a look at what they call the 10-point program for justice at Jimmy John's. The plan includes time and a half for working between midnight and 6 a.m., one paid sick day per month, maternity and paternity leave, half-hour lunch breaks when more than 6 hours are worked at a time, and other demands.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
So our newly minted governor had his grand ball last night, and today being his first full day on the job, many are thinking that Governor Corbett has his eye on the coveted school voucher program that Republicans and really a growing number of Democrats have been singing. Personally, I think the vouchers are a bad idea, and there must be a better way to educate our kids and do so in a cost-effective manner. Especially when we're looking down the barrel of a massive, massive budget shortfall here in Pennsylvania. Ulrich Boser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, has written a piece, Return on Educational Investment, a District-by-District Evaluation of U.S. Educational Productivity. We've got it linked at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Ulrich, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I'm looking at the big budget numbers that we're looking at here in Pennsylvania. They're talking about school vouchers, talking about a lot of things that I got to be honest, I don't think are going to help.
No, I mean, I think with these massive sagging revenues and budget gaps, people are putting all sorts of ideas on the table. And, you know, with this report, we really want to make sure that we keep our eyes on the prize here. And it is to ensure that students achieve well in school and are prepared for a career and prepared for college. And that's why we did this report, to keep in mind that it is possible, even in these pretty tight fiscal times, that we can make reforms that are going to continue to help improve student achievement.
Well, let's talk about the report that you guys have put out. Tell me a little bit, what are your findings?
Sure. So we found that productivity varies widely within states, and really what we looked at was student achievement compared to expenditures after adjusting for things that are outside of the control of a district. So we made sure to adjust for the fact that it costs more to educate students from low-income backgrounds, students who are in special education. We also adjusted for cost of living differences. And what we found is that, you know, low productivity is costing the nation's school system as much as $175 billion a year. That's about 1% of the GDP. But we also see, you know, seeds of what we need to do to reform. And we saw in California and in other states that a low productivity could see as much as a 25% boost in achievement if it increased its efficiency from the lowest level to the highest, all else being equal.
All right. Well, explain to me exactly what you mean by low productivity. One of the things that I've been saying for years is what we're turning education into. We're turning the teaching profession into factory work, where children are just little vessels that we dump knowledge into, and it's really turning into factory work where we're creating little test takers but not critical thinkers. So explain to me a little bit what low productivity means.
Sure, no, I think that's a great question, and I think what we saw from No Child Left Behind, that a lot of schools and districts, I think their first response was, oh, okay, now we're being tested here in reading and math, that means we have to drop things like arts and science. And, you know, what we've seen from the research is that, you know, students do well on these even reading math exams if they're just, you know, well-rounded and receive a good education in the basics, and that teaching to the test really isn't going to be the answer. What we did look at, though, specifically was fourth and eighth grade and high school reading and math schools, and then we looked and compared those against school district expenditures. And what we really wanted to emphasize is that some school districts are able to get high scores but keep expenditures low. And I think in this particular time when we're seeing these sagging budget revenues, we have to look to those districts and see what they're doing. You know, some of the reforms are working within the community. So we saw a school district in Massachusetts that combined their technology department at the school district with that of the town in order to reduce expenses and to introduce some cost efficiencies in the way that they were operating business. And that includes, you know, working with unions. It includes community support. It means being smart about the bottom line, but making sure that you're focused on having high achievement for all students.
Yeah, for me, I got to be honest, having grown up in a housing project, for me, I do believe that the biggest thing that can be done is to work with people in the home, to help parents who may not have a great education, get them involved, because I think it's just a lot bigger than putting all of the responsibility on the backs of teachers. I mean, teachers are great and they do a great job, but I think there are a lot of factors that most people don't even want to talk about. We want to talk about these simple silver bullet ideas like school vouchers, that we're going to create all this competition, they claim. But if the kids aren't ready to learn when they come to school, I don't know how that a teacher is going to change that all that much.
I see exactly what you're saying and agree. And I think the solution is to make sure that we don't see these things in silos, where we don't see sort of home stops here and school stops here.
Right.
We can't put things on the backs of teachers, but we also have to make sure that there's good communication with schools and parents. We have to make sure that, you know, we're not just sort of saying, oh, the county does some work over here, the city does some work over here, and the school does some work over there. Unless we really have a comprehensive sense of reform, integrating services to make sure parents are pulled into the school, to make sure that students get the health services that they need, and to think about this not in a silver bullet way, but as a comprehensive reform to figure out how we're going to best educate students from all backgrounds is going to be key. And, you know, we want to make sure that we don't just sort of say, oh, we're just going to make these 10% cuts or reach to these, unfettered market-based reforms like vouchers, but really concentrate on making sure that public services are public services and serve the public.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Ulrich Boser, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He analyzes education, criminal justice, and social policy. His piece, Return on Educational Investment, you can get there from our site at thericksmithshow.com. You know, here in Pennsylvania, we've changed governors. Governor Ed Rendell was I got to be honest, a very good governor with regard to spending on education. But what we're hearing now is with the new administration and a lot of people around this, well, you know, spending doesn't really matter. We need to do a whole bunch of other things. And my point is, you know, spending isn't the silver bullet, but not spending is worse.
We have to be careful about our spending, and we have to make investments that we know are going to work for the future. I think Governor Rendell wisely invested in preschool, where we see those dividends paying off in elementary school and high school and beyond, and those are worthwhile investments. And you know, that is a legacy of his that we certainly hope will continue. But you know, clearly in this time of budget cuts, of fiscal tightening, we do have to figure out how to do more with less. And I think the best way to have that conversation is to make sure that it's an open conversation, a frank conversation about where we are there areas that we can cut, and are there, even better than that, areas where we can operate a little bit more efficiently.
Yeah, I'm with you there, but you know, you keep hearing this, and it's almost a talking point that, well, you know, spending doesn't equal higher achievement. And I point to your report. You talk about Howard County in Maryland, their school district there, that they spend, I think it was like $3,000 more than the national average. And as you pointed out in a magazine, they were heralded as an academic powerhouse. So clearly some spending there equated into better outcomes.
Absolutely. You know, spending matters, certainly above a threshold level. It's just absolutely key. You know, I think the question then is sort of above some certain level, what can we do to get more out of our buck? And then also, I think the important conversation within this is to also make sure that funds are distributed equitably. We had to do a lot in our report to make sure that we could have this conversation to make adjustments for the fact that funds are often distributed inequitably within states. Some states are better than others. Some states, in fact, you see students from higher income backgrounds actually getting more money from the state. So there has to be a number of things on the table that we have to be wise about and prudent about as we're going forward, because the fiscal times certainly for education are going to be worse before they get better. Property taxes in most states is what funds schools and districts, and property values lag behind. And so I think we're going to see hard years for many years, if not decades, to come.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, in going back to the report, some of the things you were talking about were training, that you talked about teachers who, you know, on this merit-based idea that, you know, teachers who were doing the best that they could do and they had hit a certain plateau, talking about training and moving forward. Can you talk a little bit about that in your research? What kind of training are you talking about, and do you see much of it going on now?
When we talked about training, it was really thinking about administrators, training them how to think about spending dollars a little bit more wisely. Right now in this country, we don't do a good job even tracking where education dollars are being spent. So we had our study looked at the district level, largely because there isn't data at school level, at the school level to figure out how dollars are spent. And so we really argued it as part of this report that we need a smarter, fairer way to approach funding, and we need to do more to think about and track how dollars are spent to make sure that we give teachers the resources that they need, as well as to ensure that we have strong student achievement across the board.
You know, and looking at education, I've always been a strong proponent of longer school days, more school days, so that you would have greater hands-on or experiential learning. Because I think the more time you spend at it, the better we're off we're going to be. But that, again, is going to cost money. Because what's happened in our society is we've dumped the responsibility, I think, of raising our kids onto the school districts. Because, honestly, both parents have to work. Things are tough. And, you know, that's kind of the idea that I have.
You know, it's interesting, though, because a longer school day doesn't always have to cost more money. Just last week, Charlotte Mecklenburg in North Carolina decided to extend the school day for elementary school. They were able to save $4 million in their budget by matching the bus schedule for the elementary school kids with the high school kids, right? So you didn't actually have to pay extra for busing. And you had, I think, exactly your point where you're extending the school day, allowing kids to have more time in school, more time in learning, whether they devote that to experimental learning or science or math. But it's key that we kids do need to spend more time in school. When you look at us versus other nations, students spend a lot less time in school. And so I think that is, though, an example of, I mean, if you think creatively of areas that we can save a little money and increase student achievement, and that's exactly the type of thing that this report is talking about.
All right. If you want to check out the report, Return on Educational Investment, just go to thericksmithshow.com, click on Ulrich Boser's name. Ulrich, I appreciate your time, and thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Rick.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Gollies, America is still an exporting powerhouse. In fact, our corporate chieftains have made us number one in exporting America's most precious goods, our jobs, factories, technologies, and middle-class opportunities. With unemployment and underemployment devastating millions of families in our country, perhaps you've assumed that U.S. corporations aren't hiring these days. Nonsense. They added 1.4 million jobs last year alone, overseas. For example, more than half of Caterpillar's new hires in 2010 were in foreign countries. Many more of this giant's jobs are headed offshore in the near future, for Caterpillar, which was once an iconic American brand, has recently invested in three new plants in China. It'll not only manufacture tractors and bulldozers there, but it'll also begin to ship its design work and technology development jobs to China. Likewise, DuPont, once proud of its U.S. workforce, has slashed its number of American employees in recent years while increasing its Asia-Pacific workforce by more than half. Indeed, DuPont no longer considers itself American. We're a global player, sniffs its chief innovation officer. Such homemade brands as Coca-Cola, Dell, and IBM are also among the multitude of corporations abandoning our shores and our middle class. Of course, they still keep their well-appointed headquarters here so the corporation and top executives can continue enjoying all that America has to offer. Calvin Coolidge once asserted that what's good for business is good for America. That was myopic enough, but today's narcissistic CEOs are even more self-serving, declaring that what's good for business is good for business. America be damned. This is Jim Hightower saying, if we're to have a united society, America cannot tolerate such raw selfishness by the privileged few. We can have a plutocracy or a democracy, but not both.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Missed any portion of the program? Right there for your entertainment at thericksmithshow.com. You can also download the program through Apple's iTunes. There's a link right there on our site for that. Last night we talked a little bit about the college student from Colorado University, who paid his tuition in cash. Walked into the registrar and said, here are 14,000 $1 bills, which I thought was great. Personally, I would have made it one short to make them recount it, but that's just me. And look, this protest was brought on by the fact that we've seen serious cuts in education and the rising cost of education. And someone sent me this chart that talks about inflation and the inflation nightmare that college education has undergone over the last 10 years. It has gone up 100% over the last 10 years. You want to talk about massive inflation? 100%. In fact, it's gone up so much higher that it's beat healthcare, because healthcare has only gone up 50% over the last 10 years. It has doubled the inflation rate of even healthcare. And, you know, at some point, we've got to talk about how to control that. Healthcare is a part of it. Most teacher contracts are held up over healthcare. We've got to talk about some of the administrative stuff. I was looking at administrative numbers where you've got, you know, superintendents in this state, 500 of them. Do you really need that many? Maybe start talking about combining some school districts. But what we're getting from the right, what we're getting from our Republicans and a lot of Democrats, is this idea of privatization, this idea of vouchers. We need market-based solutions. We've been hearing a lot of this lately. We need charter schools and cyber charter and all of these other things, all these products. Because education, and even our last guest, who, you know, we agreed on a lot of things, even he was talking in the vernacular of business, productivity, which I still don't understand what the answer on low productivity meant. But as we move forward, we're going to keep hearing this. And to me, education is not a factory job. Teachers teaching my children, I don't want them looking at their job of how do I make this Mr. Smith's children good test takers. I want good critical thinkers. I want kids who are going to see a problem and think of a solution. But that's not happening. In fact, you know, we're seeing a report just came out that many college students are not thinking critically. In fact, one of the groups that had recently done this study, this guy wrote a book, Academically Adrift. He gives the United States an F in critical thinking for college students, because we're just teaching to the test. We've made everything about getting that piece of paper and not about attaining knowledge, not about how to solve problems. And you look at on the college level, we're privatizing education at an alarming rate. Every time I turn around, I'm seeing pop-up ads for association of private college universities. They're for-profit industries, and they make big money. So we've turned education, and this is the way I see it going. We're turning this into a business where there's profit to be made. And here in Pennsylvania, we're going to be talking about this voucher idea. It's coming. It's coming down the line. And to me, it's basically just another divide and conquer scheme to steal money from the public schools and enrich the profit margins of special interests. You know, they keep talking about politicians with their whams. No more whams for the politicians. So what are we going to give them? Some state assets. You know, like, like starting your own charter school. And you look at No Child's Behind Left. I mean, No Child Left Behind. You had Bush's brother starting a testing software company, Ignite Learning Incorporated, back in 99. Why? Big money. Lots of it. In fact, he makes about $180,000 a year. Doing what? Nothing. And who gave him the money? The Saudis, the Russians, even some Mexicans. Because they see the profit. They see the ability to make a big buck off of this. And this scam, this is a scam. Understand, these vouchers are a big scam. There's big money to be had in this. Because when you give these kids their lottery ticket, here's my voucher ticket, oh boy! I've often asked, you know, if you got the winning lottery ticket and you've got nowhere to cash it in, did you win anything? And do you really think that we're going to have these lottery tickets for all of these kids to go to these private schools? Do you think that's going to happen? Do you think the kids are going to be able to attend the best of the cream de la creme of the private world? Of course not. What you're going to see is you're going to see kids turned away. And at the end of it, the people who are already sending their kids to private school getting a massive windfall. That's what's going to happen. And you look at the last election. I mean, the Democrats were almost as bad as the Republicans talking about school vouchers. The big moneyed interest have laid their bets on both sides of the aisle, thinking that, oh boy, we're gonna be able to get into the public's pocket. Education in this country should be protected. And we seem to be thinking that somehow we can open it up to the corporations, that the good benevolent corporation is going to give us money. So if we expand tax credits, which is part of Pakola's idea, that's going to be good, that'll help with education. And I ask the question, you know, how much more advertising do my kids have to endure? How much more product placement do my kids have to see? They want to open up this educational improvement tax credit. So basically steal from Peter to prove Paul right. Now they keep saying, money doesn't improve educational outcomes. Isn't that what they say to you? Isn't it? Why the raise in funding? Well, you know, they want to go back to a one-room schoolhouse, poorly paid teacher. Because according to them, according to the folks on the other side, they think anyone can do that. Anyone can be a teacher. Any idiot can do that because it's factory work. And that's what bothers me about the education system going forward. People think it's factory work. Oh, anybody can do this. And in the end, that black kid in the inner city who they're pandering to right now, this is a Republican ploy to pull African American votes away because, oh, we're the party that brought you vouchers. So when that inner city black kid gets that voucher, oh boy, do you think he's really going to get into the top private schools? I mean, they'll let a couple in. How many? You remember, and I've talked about this before, remember that swimming pool a couple years ago up in Huntington Valley, PA? The Valley Club, private club. Even this group, these day campers paid their membership dues. And then they got thrown out because they were black and Hispanic. And the president of the club said, well, you know, we were concerned. We were concerned that that a lot of kids would change the complexion and the atmosphere of the club. So do you really think they're going to open those their private schools up? Absolutely not. And what I'm waiting for, and I think this is going to be interesting, what's going to happen when we start using tax dollars through vouchers to open up a Muslim school? I can't wait to see the crazy go nut. I can't wait to see it. Because be careful what you wish for. So we'll see where this goes. I'm quite interested to see whether the governor is going to roll this out. We're told it's going to happen. So we shall see. It'll be an interesting couple of days. But for me, education, again, this is one of these things we should be focusing on how to fix our problems, not how to splinter them off and create more. And that's what they're talking about doing. This idea that somehow schools are going to compete against each other, not likely. It's not like making tennis shoes. It's not like building cars. These are our children. This is our future. So interesting times ahead. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Colleen Stevens about her ordeal with the drywall. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Executive Director of CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, for the longest time, we've been talking about the stuff coming in from China not meeting our standards, and the folks who are supposed to be overseeing this, the people who are supposed to be at the borders inspecting things, understaffed, overworked, and really an impossible battle. And even when they do find things that don't meet our standards and are sent back, they're only sent back in again because the chances are it's not going to get caught. So when we catch things, I'm often amazed that we don't have a bigger outcry, that we don't see citizens groups getting involved, like the lead in China, in toys that come from China. And this story, the drywall, and we've been talking about this for a couple of years. After some of the hurricanes, after Katrina, we saw people rebuilding homes and doing remodeling with drywall, sheetrock from China, with some really, really disastrous effects. And I've got Colleen Stevens on the line. She's with Victims of Chinese Drywall. Colleen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on your show. This is such a hot topic. It's caused catastrophe to thousands of families across the country.
Well, people need, especially while the Chinese president is here, people need to hear the stories of folks like you who have been through this. Tell me exactly what happened. Give me a baseline. Where are we starting off with this?
Let me tell you, back in 2009, in February, my daughter was really sick. She was about 11 at that point. And then a short while later, we found out that our house had been built with Chinese drywall. And her doctor said, you know, we've run a bunch of blood tests. We can't figure out why she's not getting better. Why don't you move out of the house for a week? We moved out of the house for a week and realized that she was starting to feel better, and the rest of us were starting to feel better, too. We never went back in the house. My children have not stepped into their rooms for 22 months. We lived in a trailer in the driveway, a travel trailer, with our family of five for about 3 months. And then came to the realization that this was going to be a very long legal and political process, and we had to move our family into another home in order to keep them safe and have somewhere for us to live.
You know, let me ask you, how many people do you think are in a similar position that you find yourself in?
The CPSC has an estimate of 3,770 reports at this point, but I can tell you there are way more than that. Unfortunately, we believe that a lot of the homeowners in Florida and the Gulf Coast states have just walked from their homes because, well, the real estate economy crashed. They were upside down on their homes. Then they were to find out that they had Chinese drywall and their homes were now worth nothing. So it was just easier for them to walk. We also have a large group of homeowners that don't want to report because then their home will always be labeled as being a Chinese drywall home.
Right. And I stop and I think about this, and you're fortunate because you were able to move out and you were able to go somewhere else. How many people can't do that?
I do say that. We are very fortunate. We have two big groups of people that can't do that. We have the military families, where if they move out and they get foreclosed on or have to go bankrupt because they cannot afford the place they're living to keep their family safe and the toxic home that they have to continue paying a mortgage on, then they can lose their jobs, because if you have a bankruptcy or foreclosure and you have security clearance, you can actually lose your security clearance. The other group that it has a large impact on are the retirees. Most of those people have taken their life savings and put it into their home so that they don't have a mortgage. So they can't move out and take on a mortgage or rent someplace else in order to live in a safe environment. So they are still living in these toxic homes. Some people with their windows open all the time trying to keep it aired out. Some people keep their air conditioning running all the time. They don't know what the answer is to keep it as safe as possible for them to live in there.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, we hear a lot about the CDC. Have they done anything? Are they running studies? Anything?
No. We actually do not even have a contact after 2 years of this at the CDC for somebody who was working on this. We have asked, I can't tell you how many times, for a contact there on somebody who's doing a study. And we have nothing. The only report that the CDC has put out so far says that if you can't breathe in your Chinese drywall home, to step outside and get a breath of fresh air.
No.
Also asked,
no, come on, they didn't say that.
I can't make that up. It's actually on their website. Take a look.
You have got to be, oh, just, yeah, don't worry about it. Just go outside.
Right, take a step outside. We've asked Washington over and over again. You know, even if the CDC is not going to start doing a study on what our future health implications are, at least start gathering the data from the homeowners that have Chinese drywall so that you can see what our similar situations have been and what a lot of us are still having to deal with even after moving out of the home.
So help me here, because, you know, I thought this whole, and this is where my ignorance may come in, I thought this whole Chinese drywall thing happened during the hurricanes because we couldn't produce enough of it, so we had to bring it in from outside the country. So what you're telling me, you weren't involved in any disasters, no, nothing burned down, nothing fell down?
I wasn't, no, because I'm in Virginia. We have a supplier here in Virginia who hired an importer to go to China and look for the drywall and bring it in at the price that he could get it at in China and turn around and sell it to the Virginia homeowners.
Wow. And all to save a couple of bucks. So I guess my next question is then, Colleen, is, you know, how many people are out there that are living with this, that are living with the ailments that your children had, that you had, and don't even know why?
Right. It even goes a step beyond that, too. How safe is it to live in these homes? Because this... these gases corrode all the copper, silver in your home. And if you think about it, your wires, your plumbing, your gas lines are all made with copper. I can tell you, in my house, we had gas leaks all the time. They were small gas leaks. I'd go into the attic. I'd smell something. We'd call and have somebody come out. They didn't know why it was leaking. They, you know, try and figure out where. But now we know. The gas lines were probably leaking from the corrosion from the copper pipes.
Amazing. And, you know, the thing is we keep telling people to seal their homes and seal all the cracks and tighten it up to save energy, to save heat. And chances are, in one of these homes, you could be making things much, much worse.
We actually have that thought, too, from the homes that have the foam insulation. You know, it's not allowing as much air breathing in between the inside and the outside. So did that make those homes a lot more toxic on the inside? We don't know.
So with your house in particular, have you done anything to try and remediate? Do you try and have someone, you know, pull the drywall out, put new stuff in? Is that possible?
You know, back in the beginning when this first happened, we had a neighborhood group that had suggested they would do like an extreme home makeover type thing and bring in the builders and tear it out. But at that point, we knew nothing about this drywall. And how safe or unsafe it was to send workers in there. And the thought of sending in friends, neighbors to do something like that was just not something I could do. So we figured we'd wait for some answers from the government on how to remediate these homes and what type of safety equipment the workers would need to go into these homes. We're still waiting. 22 months later.
That's just absolutely amazing to me.
It is. It's amazing. We don't know how it got into this drywall. We are not even sure. I mean, they're telling us hydrogen sulfide, Carbon disulfide has been thrown around, carbinyl sulfide. These are the gases that they're telling us, but how did they get into drywall? And why is it continuing to off-gas? We don't know any of these answers, even after the CPSC, Consumer Product Safety Commission, spent $5 million studying these houses. And mine was one of them. They did a 52-house study.
And what did they conclude?
They concluded that they think it's hydrogen sulfide, and that's about as far as we've gotten. They have an interim remediation protocol out there, which says that everything needs to come out of the house, the drywall, and anything that's copper.
And who's going to have to pay for that?
That's the big question. We really don't know that answer yet. And that's a legal issue. You know, people say, well, sue your builder. Okay, well, you know how long lawsuits take.
Well, he'll file bankruptcy, and then you're out no matter what.
Well, that's really it. Right now, the best way that it's been explained to us is we have two avenues. We go after the insurance industry, or we go after China. We're doing both right now, but take a guess on how good we're going to do on those kinds of lawsuits.
Yeah, you're not going to do real well in China because they're just going to thumb their nose and keep walking down the road. But the reality is, to me, this comes back down to our trade policies.
It
comes back down to, you know, that store in your community who decided, you know what, I could make a couple of pennies by buying something cheap and shoddily made in China and put it in my pocket, and I don't care about anybody else.
Exactly. Go into the stores and just about everything, especially if you're looking for anything for your kitchen, the things that we eat out of, any of the small kitchen appliances are made in China. Utensils, there are not any utensils made in the United States of America anymore.
Yeah,
plates, glasses, everything is made in China.
I'm absolutely amazed at how little consumers seem to care that everything that we purchase. And it's been very quick. It's only been about 10, 15 years that we've gone from producing things here to not.
I'm shocked, too. You know, we've said that even people that we know who've seen what we've gone through, how do you go into the stores and still continue to buy made in China? Then we have another large group of friends and family and neighbors and associates who all say they walk into the stores now and think of us. And really, that is the only way we're going to get this to change. After our last year of numerous trips to Washington, constant contact with our representatives, the answer is going to have to come from the American public, where they walk into the store and see made in China and put it back on the shelf.
But here's the problem with that, and I've had this argument with people before. You know, there's no alternative. I mean, you get this.
We have seen that, like I said, with the kitchen utensils.
Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely amazing on how. And it's not that they built a better product. It's not that they were smarter. It's that our businesses, that American corporations, decided that, hey, let's go make our product over there because we can make a lot of profit.
That needs to be part of the legal system too. You know, whoever made money off of this, you're liable.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely just a horrible situation. And, you know, I look at this and I don't envy you. I don't think it's going to end well for you.
No, we don't either.
And I encourage my listeners to call their representatives, to tell them, you know, we got to look at our trade policies to protect folks like you, Colleen.
We don't even just stand to lose the equity in our homes. We stand to lose everything else because if we get foreclosed upon, what's next?
Right.
They come take everything else you own.
And not to mention what was in your house that, you know, who knows what kind of contamination.
Oh, we've left anything that's fabric furniture, bedding, that's all left behind.
Amazing story. And I appreciate you coming on and sharing it with us, Colleen. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave, make us play nice, let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Auto Workers helped announce Tuesday that Ford is investing $400 million in its Kansas City assembly plant over the next 2 years. That factory will produce a new line of next-generation vehicles. It currently produces the Ford F-150 pickup and Ford Escape. The UAW says the investment will secure thousands of direct and supporting jobs in the Kansas City area. UAW Vice President Jimmy Settles says the union is pleased to have the cooperation of labor, business, and government working together to retain good jobs in Missouri. UE's Chris Townsend says workers at the Taunton, Massachusetts Esterline Technologies Haskin plant are considering an improved severance offer. The UE Local 204 Executive Board is recommending the workers accept the deal, and they'll vote on it later this week. So the planned action to try and stop an auction of the plant's equipment Wednesday has been called off.
I'll never second-guess our local members. I think that they battled this thing out to the 25th hour, did the very best they could with all of the heavy artillery pointed at them. For anyone even imagining what it might be like to be in the shoes of somebody in this situation, some folks presumably who are listening have been through this, is that there's an absolutely natural, reasonable tendency to look a little more fondly on the bird in the hand as opposed to the very sketchy or promissory bird in the bush.
Minneapolis Jimmy John's workers will get another chance at electing to join the IWW after losing by just two votes in an election nullified because the company violated labor law. Jesse Russell reports.
An attempt to organize nearly 200 workers for Jimmy John's sandwich shops in Minneapolis has been anything but freakishly fast. The industrial workers of the world won the right for a union election on October 22nd. And lost by a vote of 87-85. However, the IWW alleged to the National Labor Relations Board that the company had engaged in unlawful union-busting tactics. The union alleged that Jimmy John's threatened to freeze wages and to retaliate against union supporters. On January 10th, the NLRB ruled in favor of the union and nullified the election. After 60 days, the IWW will be allowed to file for a new election. As the union works toward a new election, workers are asking the company's owners to take a look at what they call the 10-point program for justice at Jimmy John's. The plan includes time and a half for working between midnight and 6 a.m., one paid sick day per month, maternity and paternity leave, half-hour lunch breaks when more than 6 hours are worked at a time, and other demands.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell.
I agree. I think it is time for a change. Already I'm looking at the T-Twizzlers there in Congress going, oh, 2 years of this, are you kidding me? All this wasted money arguing over something that is going to go nowhere. And they know it's not going anywhere. This is all to score political points. This is not about leading this country in the right direction. And my problem with politics in general is that you have folks who are out there for their radical self-interest. And again, you know, there's a part of a positive part of that as well. But we need folks who are like us. You know, I had someone tell me recently that there are very few people in Washington or in the halls of power here in Harrisburg who wear a t-shirt to work like I do, or who wear a t-shirt at all, and they don't even know many people that wear t-shirts. Just one of those things. But the coming months we're going to be talking about bigger elections. To me, you know, the presidential election is important, but the real important elections are your local elections, which bothered me that you don't get people out to vote as much as you do in a presidential, but it's the local people that affect us the most. That's why I've asked Mike Fedor to come out and talk to us. He is running for Cumberland County Commissioner. I'm excited about it. Mike, welcome to the program.
Rick, thanks for having me.
You know, it's nice to see people like me running for office, folks who get up every day and go to work and bust their behind to help the average person.
Well, thanks, Rick. I mean, it's a great compliment coming from you, and I really appreciate it. And I think it's time we have somebody as a county commissioner in Cumberland County for the next 4 years is going to know what it takes to go to work every day, feed a family, and try to make it in this economy. So I'm looking forward to representing working class people in Cumberland County if I can win the nomination in in May.
Yeah, you know, one of my big things about people holding political office is, you know, what's their vision? What do they see the future being, especially in this area? Because I think I think people like to think, you know, tomorrow is going to be the same as it was today. But the reality is, as we look tomorrow and down the road, this area is going to change and rapidly. And if we don't have someone with the vision to see that, I think we're really in big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, that's the real thing that we need in local government these days are visionary, bold leaders, people who can see things not just as they are, but what they can be. Cumberland County is one of those counties that is growing rapidly, and, you know, people love it. Like my wife and I, we loved what Cumberland County had to offer. We have two young children, Jackson and Parker, and we wanted to make sure that we were living in a place that was going to be really great for them to grow up. And so that kind of stuff doesn't happen by accident. It takes hard work to make a county a great place to live, and it's got to be cooperation between local governments, county government, school districts, small businesses, workers. Everyone's got to be working together. So, you know, where do we go for the next 4 years? Well, we've got to be thinking about, you know, growing the economy in a regional way, creating a sense of clear identity for our county. What is it that we're about? What makes it a great place to live, and why would a business want to come and locate there? If you've ever been to Cumberland County, you know that Camp Hill is very different from Shippensburg. And so, you know, we've got to have leaders that can see that we have a diverse county, a diverse economy, and that we have to be able to build with the whole county in mind.
Well, that's one of the things that, again, my wife and I enjoy about it as well. The thing that scares me, and I haven't driven a truck for a number of years, you see one place after another, and it all begins to look the same. We've become this homogenous society. And I hope this county doesn't lose that.
No, I mean, it's so easy for counties to just become this, you know, this sprawling development of, you know, big box store, just chasing, you know, the next piece of development after another. You know, maintaining critical, clear identity communities is essential to the long-term growth of Cumberland County. You know, Camp Hill has got to look different from Mechanicsburg, and Carlisle has got to be a different experience than Shippensburg. And what they have to offer as an economy and as a way of life should be different, so people have a choice and they make decisions about where to live.
You know, I go back 10 years, and talking about vision and talking about leadership, I look back 10 years and I go, what would have happened had you had a leader 10 years ago who said, you know what? I-81 is going to become so backed up. The traffic is going to increase so much in the next 10 years. We need to give our citizens an option. We need to do some public transportation, be it, you know, bus lines or high speed rail or light rail going into Harrisburg or other places. Had we had that vision 10 years ago, I think the congestion that I have to deal with every day on 81 would be less.
Yeah, you know, we have to build a culture of commuting within the county to where people work. It's got to be about, you know, making it easy for people to make that choice to ride a bus or ride a train or to carpool. And, you know, county government has a role to play, and it doesn't always have to be about a brand new costly program. Sometimes it's just about cooperation. I mean, we've got to be thinking about, you know, making it easier for people to park and ride, making sure that those types of locations are clearly lit and well-maintained and attractive so that you actually would drive past them on the major places you go to get to work. How about also, you know, we ought to be fighting to make, you know, the purchase of fare cards tax deductible in Pennsylvania so that, you know, you could be reducing your taxable income by $49 a month or $70 a month if you're going via CAT in Harrisburg. Or if we get something even better down the line, you know, you're able to make that choice and actually save money in the process, not to mention protecting the environment and reducing congestion by using mass transit.
Yeah, have you seen the series that they were doing in the Sentinel for the last couple of days?
Yeah.
On 81?
Mm-hmm. You know, yes, I have.
You look at that, and you read, now there have been some problems with 81, but for the most part, I don't know many people who can argue it wasn't the smart thing to do, it wasn't a good investment. This is the kind of vision that I'm talking about, the kind of vision that looks down the road, not just day after tomorrow or in 10 years, but well into the future and says, you know, this is going to be something we're going to leave for our children.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have to fight for priorities. I mean, our values say that that Cumberland County should be a fantastic place to live. It should be safe and clean, and it should be affordable for families. If those are our values, then we should be fighting for funding programs and doing projects that reflect that. And that might mean enhancing mass transit. It might mean protecting agriculture. It might be working harder to move local ag products into our local restaurants or into our cafeterias and our school districts. Those are the types of things. It's about having a vision and making all the pieces add up. And ID1's a great example of, you know, a project from long ago when we were talking about making investments in America that would create jobs at a time when it was necessary to create good jobs to sustain the economy. Here we are, I-81 again. It's being pushed beyond its original limits. Can we make the investments? Can we push to make those investments once again? And we'll put people to work expanding the I-81, but in the process, you know, mindful that that's not the only solution to moving people to work in the region. And so what other options are should be on the table, should we be looking at, should we be encouraging as county leaders to make sure that people have the services that they want?
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Mike Fedor. He's running for Cumberland County Commissioner. Your website, votefedor.com, is that up and running yet?
It is just placeholder right now. The best place to find us right now is on Facebook, facebook.com/votefedor, F-E-D-O-R. And within the next week, we'll have the web page up where you can sign up for email alerts. And you can also follow us on Twitter, Fedor4PA. I'm on all those things and trying to keep people informed of what we're going, because it's a real grassroots campaign.
And we'll make sure we get that up at thericksmithshow.com. You know, your background, impressive background in alternative energy and in how are we going to look to the future and talking about vision. You know, I look at the Carlisle School District and the solar array that they put on the school that my daughter goes to. Again, talking about that smart vision, that leadership forward. Are these the kind of things that you would be looking at as we move forward?
Absolutely. I mean, that's an example of how we talk about future technology and use it as not only a way to generate clean and renewable energy in a school district, but it becomes part of the classroom. And kids get really excited about this type of new, forward-looking technology. There's opportunities to make clear investments in small businesses and encourage some of the federal tax incentives that are available right now at the local level, so businesses can make investments in solar or wind or biofuel or whatever makes sense for where they are located. Not to mention the fact that we have out in the western part of the county some enormous agricultural lands and agricultural districts where they should be thinking about not only growing strawberries or raising beef cattle, but also harvesting wind and harvesting the sun as part of our ag. So, you know, we have to look forward. I think we have to lead, not only as a state, but as a county. We just can't sit back and wait for someone else to do it, and that's part of the reason that I'm running. I mean, I feel like I have something to offer here. I have a wonderful job. I have a wonderful family. This is an enormous commitment that I'd be making for the next 4 years, but I'm willing to do it because I think we need strong, visionary people to step forward and lead, and I think that I have something to offer for the next 4 years for my county.
All right, let's go to the phone lines quick. We got Mike on line one. Mike, you got something for Mike Fedor?
Yeah, years ago there was a big hubbub that they were going to put in light rail to connect.
Corridor one.
Yeah, and they're going to connect Carlisle eventually. And I went to a couple of meetings and I said, you know, everybody's focused on the future. We got to have this light rail, the slickest, best, the fastest, whatever. You know what? They own the rails right now. And every day, I see trucks owned by the railroad that are driving down the railroad tracks doing whatever work needs to be done. If you take the existing city buses and trick them out with the same kind of gear, you can have your light rail in a year,
yep,
rather than 10 years.
There has been talk of that.
Yeah, you know, this is the type of creative thinking we need. We don't need to build something totally from scratch. We take what we have available to us now, we put it to good use, and we do it in a smarter way.
But you see, nobody really wants to do that because there's not enough money in it for people to put in their pocket. And it can happen today. We're continuously waiting for the perfect in the future when we can have the good enough today. But nobody wants to do that because they can't make huge profit.
Excellent point, Mike. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Yeah, I think he makes a great point there, Mike Fedor.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we need to be thinking not about building things entirely from scratch, but, you know, finding out what's working now, what's available now, what can we start with, right, and build on it. Cumberland County has a tremendous financial position as a county, one of the two best bond ratings in the state. So we have the ability to leverage some resources if we need to. I know that the county is already talking about making some investments for the current year and for the future year using some of that sound fiscal position. So, you know, likewise, you know, we should be reaching out to Dauphin County, reaching out to York County, finding a way to be part of this larger community. And it's frankly not all just about transit. It's about job creation. It's about education. It's about preservation of the way of life that we have and thinking about, you know, what kind of jobs do we want our kids to have? When Jackson's 18 and he wants to go into the job market, you know, his mom and I want him to be close to home and have job opportunities here, not have to move to Arizona or Texas to go find a job.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent point, Mike. In the coming days, are you working some campaign stuff? People wanted to get involved. How would they see you? What would they do?
Well, the very first thing you can do is like us on Facebook and look us up at Facebook.com/VoteFedor. You can also email me at our campaign. It's MichaelFedor@VoteFedor.com. The first thing that we have to do is knock on doors and talk to voters. And yeah, Cumberland County Democratic Committee is meeting next month to make its endorsement, and we're fighting hard to win that. And you can help us win that. Reach out to me, and we'll help you knock on some doors with us in the next 3 weeks. Talk to these committee members and say, hey, we need a fresh face. We need new ideas. We need a new leader for the next 4 years for this county, and Michael Fedor is the guy to do it.
All right, Mike. I look forward to having you back. Thanks for coming on, and we'll talk to you very soon.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Your proud defender of the work-class majority. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Missed any portion of the program? Everything's right there for your entertainment. You can download it onto your iPod. You can just watch us right here on your computer. We do stream video as well. It's been a year since the Citizens United case, and a new report from Public Citizen has found that since that that historic decision that overturned 100 years of law precedent from the guy who said, I'm just going to call balls and strikes, that we have seen the secretive corporate and billionaire class exert an outsized influence over the elections of 2010 in their new capacity to swamp political races with unlimited cash. They have ended up more than quadrupling the spending on last year's midterm elections. Over the total spent on the last midterm of 2006, of the $294 million spent in 2010, over 77% came from groups that accepted contributions over $5,000, which is the maximum that a political committee can accept before the Supreme Court ruling. So now you're seeing all these, this big money getting into this. And one of the things that I've been talking about for the longest time is we're not going to be able to take back our democracy. We're not going to be able to get the things that we need done until we address how money influences our politics. You look here in Pennsylvania, the drilling industry spent anywhere, and I've seen numbers from $1 to $3 million electing a governor. I've seen hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on district campaigns by the drilling industry. They're going to want something back. And I remember a conversation that I had. And you know, I'm not naive enough to say that, you know, look, I'm not naive enough to say that the natural gas industry is buying Tom Corbett's vote. That he's up for sale. That I'm not going to say that. What I'm going to say is what this congressional friend of mine said. He said, you're not buying my vote. You're buying my ear. So every time I've got to pick up the phone and ask for a donation, I've got to listen to your problem. I've got to listen to your issue. I've got to listen to what you want. And the more of those calls that you get, the more it frames your thinking a little bit. You're not hearing from average everyday people. How many people have actually called their representative? How many people have visited a representative's office? Very few, percentage-wise. But the people who control the money, those folks, they know how to get a hold of their representative. They know how to play the system. They know how important that contact is. And for me, until we get money out of this, this is a done game. Because you look at the Tea Party people who went in under this, you know, we're going to right things, we're going to straighten things out. The majority of them have hired Washington lobbyists as their chief of staffs. They've recycled the same people who were always there. Is that change? Not really. Because eventually you start making those phone calls, you start hearing that message, you start buying into it. And as my friend said, look, you know, it's not that we're for sale. It's that's what we're exposed to. You know, they're buying time to get in front of you to present their issue. And the fact that congressmen and senators have to spend so much time raising money, that they spend so much time on the folks who control the purse strings, that it's only natural that they're going to start to sympathize and start to make those compromises going, well, you know what? I need another $25,000 for my campaign fund because, you know, I got to run this TV ad because this big company's attacking me. So maybe I'll listen to this. And you know what? Maybe we'll find a compromise on the bill. You know, I look at some of these, you know, these advocacy groups, and I've been talking about this Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania for a while. They don't disclose who the people who are funding them are. For me, it's all about openness. It's all about transparency. It's all about who's paying the freight. Who's the guy footing the bill? For all I know, this Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania could be funded by the Koch brothers, could be funded by Daniel Kors, could be funded by Richard Mellon Scaife. For all I know, the Olin Foundation or the Heritage Foundation, or, you know, what they kept talking about at their meeting, the Club for Growth. For all we know, Wall Street is funding them. But we're not allowed to know that because they don't have to disclose. And what I'm saying is, if you're in the political arena, open and transparent is always the best policy for we the people. Now, for the big corporate special interest, not so much. Because personally, I think we need to take corporations completely out of the equation. They're not people. Absolutely not people. We should go back. We seem to so love the founding fathers. They outlawed contributions from corporations from the start. You don't hear that talking point, do you? You don't hear the Tea Party pushing, the originalists going back to saying, well, we need to block all corporate campaign donations. Because at the start of the country, that's how it was. And you look at this last election. All the money that was spent on influencing the vote. And you look at how these polls are swung back and forth just by what's on TV. And I take this back to education, because it's so important that we're critical thinkers. It's so important that we ask the next question, which is, who's funding this message? When I see this horrible attack ad on TV against anybody, who's funding it? What are the interests behind that? How are they trying to influence me? What are they trying to push me away from? We just absorb it. And I had a conversation the other day with somebody who asked me why I didn't attack the right-wing talking head here for saying something stupid. And I go, he said something stupid again? Am I surprised? No. This time somebody reported it. Now, how many times do they get away with it? How many times do people get away with saying outlandish things because they're trying to catch attention? That's all it's about. On the right-wing side of things, it's all about outraging the outrage, getting the eye of the money people. Because we've got to take money out of this equation. And it would be relatively cheap. You think of all the money that we spend on elections. If we spend $5 or $6 a year per taxpayer and put it into a general fund, we could fund all federal elections. And our politicians, all the people in Washington, they wouldn't have to go begging corporations. They wouldn't have to go begging for money. You know what they could do? They could spend their time writing legislation. You know what they could do? They could write their own legislation instead of having to go to the corporate lobbyist and say, oh, can you do my homework for me? Because if you look at a lot of bills, that's what's happened. You look at Boehner's pledge, the grand pledge, the GOP manifesto, written by lobbyists. So when you hear the Republicans talking about, we want smaller government, understand what they really want. They want inefficient government. They want weak government. Because that's what their corporate captains are telling them. Because if you have a weak, inefficient government, you can't stand up to corporate power. And they understand that. And this talk of going back and repeal the 17th Amendment that we talked about during the campaign, that some of the Tea Twizzlers wanted to do, again, more concentration of power away from you and me. And I do believe that we have to organize around this. We have to stand up and fight for publicly financed elections. We have to fight for instant runoff voting, for instance, which would be a great thing. But as long as the moneyed interests are stacked against us and we don't realize, and this is what I said about the Tea Party from the very beginning, they were hijacked right from the start. There was some anger there, there was a spark, and there was a potential of a movement. And the moneyed interest got on it right away, and they focused the anger toward government. And the happy marching crowd was quite thrilled to walk right along. You know, it's the government's fault that millions of jobs have fled the country. It's the government's fault that, we're in the economic situation we're in, that Wall Street collapsed. It's regulation. And I say it's just the opposite. It's our bizarre trade policies that have broken down trade barriers. It's the fact that we have few regulations on Wall Street that allowed them to do the really dumb things they did. And now it's this healthcare bill that they're trying to destroy. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Mark Steer, Executive Director of Penn Action, about the repealing job-killing healthcare law act. And the vote that happened today, 245 to 189, three Democrats crossed over. We're going to take a quick break, right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
By gollies, America is still an exporting powerhouse. In fact, our corporate chieftains have made us number one in exporting America's most precious goods. Our jobs, factories, technologies, and middle-class opportunities. With unemployment and underemployment devastating millions of families in our country, perhaps you've assumed that U.S. corporations aren't hiring these days. Nonsense. They added 1.4 million jobs last year alone, overseas. For example, more than half of Caterpillar's new hires in 2010 were in foreign countries. Many more of this giant's jobs are headed offshore in the near future, for Caterpillar, which was once an iconic American brand, has recently invested in three new plants in China. It'll not only manufacture tractors and bulldozers there, but it'll also begin to ship its design work and technology development jobs to China. Likewise, DuPont, once proud of its U.S. workforce, has slashed its number of American employees in recent years while increasing its Asia-Pacific workforce by more than half. Indeed, DuPont no longer considers itself American. We're a global player, sniffs its chief innovation officer. Such homemade brands as Coca-Cola, Dell, and IBM are also among the multitude of corporations abandoning our shores and our middle class. Of course, they still keep their well-appointed headquarters here so the corporation and top executives can continue enjoying all that America has to offer. Calvin Coolidge once asserted that what's good for business is good for America. That was myopic enough, but today's narcissistic CEOs are even more self-serving, declaring that what's good for business is good for business. America be damned. This is Jim Hightower saying, if we're to have a united society, America cannot tolerate such raw selfishness by the privileged few. We can have a plutocracy or a democracy, but not both.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, talking about hypocrisy and lies. 650,000 jobs, the Republicans were saying today. We're going to lose 650,000 jobs. The CBO said so. Only if you read what the CBO actually said, it actually said people are going to choose to leave the workforce, which means that those jobs aren't going anywhere. What you're going to see are jobs opening up, so maybe the unemployed can walk into it. But the Republican, that's not the mean, that's not the message the Republicans want to send. What they want to send is the title of their bill, Repealing the Job Killing Healthcare Law Act. 245 to 189, three Democrats jumped over. I got Mike Steer on the line. Mark, welcome to the program. Executive Director of Penn Action, PennAction.org. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you look at this really a waste of taxpayers' dollars today. The fact that this is going to do nothing other than political grandstanding. And I got to wonder, are they going to pay a price for this, do you think?
Well, you know what? Here's my take on it. I hope they try to repeal health care reform every 3 months from now for the next 2 years. Because every time they do this, it gives us another opportunity to tell people what's in the law. And the more people hear about the law, the more they like it. I think the polls I saw in the last week or so are trending in our favor again. It's totally a waste of money. It's a waste of hot air. But I think it's working to our advantage, so let them do it.
Well, yeah, but here's my problem is if we're in this big hole financially and they're the budget hawks, they're the people who are going to trim the budgets and make sure that our bills are paid and be fiscally responsible, I'm sorry, I don't want to pay people to come to work to not do their job.
Well, you know, if we're gonna call out the Republicans for the hypocrisy by budget deficits, we would have nothing else to do. all we want to do is that. I mean, really, you know, they want to lower taxes on the very wealthy, and then they want to say we have a deficit problem. They want to repeal a bill that's going to reduce the deficit by huge amounts, and then they say, well, we have a deficit problem. They rely on the CBO scores when it makes it harder to pass the legislation, and when the CBO says, you know, if you repeal this legislation, it'll cost $230 billion, they say, well, that's their opinion. I mean, you know, hypocrisy runs rampant among the Republicans these days.
Well, it's, you brought up the Pelosi talking point. The once people find out what's in it, they'll like it. And you're right. As we're finding out more and more what's in it, I think the polls are showing. The polls are trending towards people going, well, maybe it is good. Which I would have wished the Democrats would have done. Oh, I don't know, a year and a half ago. but you know, we're where we are. Let's talk about some of the positive things that have come out of this. What are a couple of things that you think are good in this?
You know what? I want to talk about one example, because she's from Pennsylvania, Stacey Ritter, who has been a great spokesperson on health care.
No,
she testified at a hearing yesterday that the Democratic Steering and Policy Committee held, and she talked about the fact about how her kids, when they were 4 years old, got leukemia, how her family went bankrupt because her husband had to take family leave to take care of the kids. They went on COBRA. It was incredibly expensive. If we had this legislation in place and there was an exchange and they could get decent health insurance with a government subsidy, they never would have gone bankrupt. So that's something that's going to benefit all of us. And then Stacey talked about another key point. Her kids now have a pre-existing condition. And her greatest fear in life is that her kids will be in the same position her family was in, and because of that pre-existing condition, would not be able to find affordable insurance. This law protects people against abuses of insurance company. It stops those insurance companies from charging people more or denying them insurance if they have a pre-existing condition. Roughly half of Americans over the age of 25 have some kind of pre-existing condition that would make it impossible for them to get affordable health insurance if they lost their job. Now, if that isn't something that is hugely important to the majority of American people, what else is?
I guess the quick response I would have is the response I've gotten from folks is, you know, it's not me. It couldn't happen to me. Doesn't not my problem.
Well, up until 2 years ago, when I wound up in the hospital with a condition that now gives me a pre-existing condition, I guess I would have said the same thing.
But as we move forward, yeah, as we get older, we're going to have these things pop up, and you know,
if we're lucky, we're going to have illnesses that are pre-existing conditions. If we're not lucky, we're going to die. Those are really our alternatives. Ultimately, we're all going to get something that we're going to need medical care for.
And the question is how do we get people quality access? How do we make sure that everyone's covered? And you know, we don't have people going bankrupt because they got sick.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Because you know, that can happen to all of us. You know, the family we knew and we met in when we were starting the campaign in Allentown. The wife has got MS. She discovered something she didn't know before, that there was a $2 million limit on medical care under her insurance plan. She thought it was great insurance. Remember, she heard about $2 million. She said, that's not a big deal. Well, with MS, she used up that $2 million in about 28 months. So that family was thinking about getting divorced so that she could get medical assistance without them having to get rid of their house.
That's a good family values position.
You know, what kind of country is it where we force people to get divorced to get the medical care we need? I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah,
and again, this is something that can happen to any of us. Have you ever looked at your insurance policy to see what the annual limit is?
Yeah, in fact, my old plan used to be $1 million per family. And a quick story that goes along with that, it used to be $1 million per family. And one of the guys we worked with, his wife had a heart attack and his son had leukemia. And they burned through that, just like you're saying, they burned through, hit the cap, and he was having to look for another job. Fortunately, we were members of a union, and our union actually held our insurance, and we were able to petition the union to raise it to $1 million per member of the family.
Right.
Which gave them some room. But here again, that was, and this is, you know, going back, I think 12, 13 years now, that I learned about that. And it surprised me back then that, you know, you're insured, but only up to a certain point.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and $1 million nowadays, that's nothing. That's not a lot of money if you get cancer, if you need a quadruple bypass or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the people have greater problems. Here's a story of someone who actually had good insurance. A woman who's the wife of a friend of mine winds up in the hospital. It turns out she has a kind of congenital defect in her heart. It's totally fixable. But this friend of mine sees the doctors huddling, talking to a hospital administrator. They're having a conversation for 45 minutes. And then finally one of them came over to the guy and said, thank God your insurance covers this, because 75% of the insurance we see would not cover this operation. It wasn't even that complicated operation, but it made the difference between her and a couple of years. And 75% of people have insurance that would not have covered that congenital problem.
That's amazing. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Mark Steer, Executive Director of Penn Action, their website, pennaction.org. You know, we heard the Republicans today talking a lot. I watched C-SPAN a little bit today talking about we need to lower costs and improve access. I heard that 100 times. But, you know, I asked the question, where have you been for the last, 50 years? Where's this magic silver bullet that you now seem to think you have to lower the costs and improve access? But all I'm hearing are platitudes. I'm not hearing any plans. I'm not hearing any, hey, let's do this.
Yeah, I mean, really, where do we get the nerve to say we're going to repeal this because it doesn't meet the goals, which, by the way, the legislation actually does meet those goals. It doesn't improve access. It does reduce costs. But how do you say we're going to repeal it and set without a substitute? I think that's part of the reason why we're being benefited by this attempt to repeal. Because in a sense, American people are saying, you know, put your cards on the table. You say you got a better plan, but you don't. Then why don't you pass the better plan? And as part of passing a better plan, repeal this one. But if you're coming to the table with nothing, and all you're saying is take away these rights that were just recently passed, and I've got nothing to replace it, you know, they're basically calling their own bluff.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, we don't even have to do it for them. They're doing it themselves.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the American people are paying attention to that, though. Because for me, look, there's some things in the bill that I'm not happy with. I think everybody sees that way. But for me, it's a starting point. In 30 or 40 years, I hope it's much better, just like Medicare. It didn't start off the way it is. You had to work through some of your problems. I wish they would say, okay, this is what I don't like, and here's my solution, instead of saying, let's just scrap the whole thing. And I was listening to C-SPAN today, and one of the callers on the Republican line called in and said, well, you know, the Democrats got, you know, 8 or 9 things that are good. We ought to use those and scrap the other 2,300 pages. And I'm just going, really? You think the whole bill, every page of the bill has just mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, well, you know, we have disagreements on our side about the bill. A lot of folks would have preferred single-payer. A lot of us were disappointed that we didn't get a public option. But I want to tell you something. We said all along the bill wasn't everything we wanted, but it's something we can build on. And we already are. But I don't know how many people listening to this know that California has already passed an implementation law that will create a public option in California. So eighth of the country will have a public option. There are at least three or four other big states that I think will also pass a law. I would predict that by the time this bill goes through in 2014, there will be a public option in a quarter of the country. And two or three more years, when people see that the states with a public option have cheaper health insurance, we'll all get it.
Now, and I agree with you there. For me, though, and this is where my whole single-payer philosophy comes from, is I do see there being a benefit from one entity covering you from cradle to grave. Because there's no incentive to push off preventative care down the line. Because what's going on now is you got the insurance companies who know that at the end of the line you're going to get Medicare. So if they can push you off onto that, like diabetes, for instance, if they don't give you the testing strips, if they don't give you the stuff to, you know, to help control it, they know that 95% of amputations due to diabetes paid for by Medicare. So they're not going to have to bear that cost. That's my theory in wanting a program that follows you from start to end.
Yeah, I think there's some good reasons why single payer would be beneficial. I think there's some potential problems with single payer. My guess is we'll wind up someplace like France or Germany, which has universal coverage, which has regulations that basically take care of the problem you're pointing to, that has an insurance market that's so heavily regulated that it's really as good or if not better than single payer. You know, France and Germany have multiple payers, but they compete in a heavily regulated market, and
I'd be all right.
The healthcare there is probably the best in the entire world.
Now, let me ask you this last question I've got for you. We've got a new governor today. Yesterday was his big debutante ball, so today, first day on the job. He's going to be the guy in charge of setting up our portion of this law. How do you think that's going to go?
This is something we've been talking a lot about among the healthcare advocates. Here's what I think our options are. Either they're going to move a piece of legislation that actually really does implement the law, or we are going to try to block that law altogether and force the state into a federal exchange, because that's an option. And we're working in Washington to try to make the federal exchange as good as possible. And what we're going to be doing in Pennsylvania is saying, you know, either we do a decent law here that really creates an exchange that's open to everyone, that gives people the best quality of insurance, that gets them the subsidies they need, or we're going to do everything we can to block the implementation law and we'll go in the federal program. And I think that's a real lever we have, because it's always easier to stop something than to pass something. And for years, Republicans, particularly in the Senate, have been blocking good legislation that we wanted, and really, you know, stifling progressive ideas that sometimes get passed in the House. Well, this might be our turn. We might just say, all right, we're going to play that game. We're going to block the implementation law in Pennsylvania, and we'll go into the federal program, which we think will be pretty good.
Yeah, we'll see how that works. And I look forward to having you back on, talk about this as we move forward in this, Mark. I appreciate your time.
I'm happy to be here. You know, we thought this campaign would come to an end someday, but it looks like we still have a long way to go to make sure that we have quality, affordable health care for everyone.
I think so. Thanks, Mark. Mark Steer, Executive Director of Penn Action. PennAction.org is their website. You can get there from our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Mark's name. Take you right there. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Hurrah, the good old union has come in here to thrill. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
All right, you know, that's the question. Which side in this whole thing are you going to be on? This health care issue, you know, for those of us who work for a living, those of us who depend on it, you know, we can't reach into our pocket and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in the event of a catastrophe. We need health care, and the working people of this country need it. You know, and Mark was talking about Stacey Ritter, who we had had at one of our events, who just an amazing woman, and the trials that her family has gone through, just remarkable. The fact that they filed bankruptcy, the fact that they've had to fight every step of the way to get the health care that their kids need. And two of the most beautiful little girls you'll ever see. And, you know, it speaks volumes about our country when that kind of stuff goes on. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Adam on line one. How are we doing tonight, Adam?
How you doing, Rick?
Good.
I had a question. I didn't know if you could help me out or fill me in. I know, you know, this whole dog and pony show with we're going to repeal health care, and it's not going anywhere. And even if it would get out of the Senate, it's just going to be vetoed. But I have heard a lot, mainly on a lot of conservative talk shows, about, well, you know, Congress controls the purse. And even if we can't repeal it, we're just going to pull the funding on it. We're just going to defund it. And I didn't know if that's a feasible thing or that's just, you know, a lie that's putting out, you know, so they can cover their behinds. Or I didn't know if you knew anything about that.
Well, the truth of the matter is Congress controls the purse. They're the ones who appropriate the money. If they choose to defund it, which they do to a lot of programs wither on the vine. They never repeal them. They just take the money out of it and they die. And, you know, the conservatives are good at that. You know, the old Grover Norquist quote.
You know, I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You know, the fact that they want to shrink the size of government. And you look at the cuts that they're talking about, these really deep, draconian cuts to programs across the board. Healthcare is going to be one of them, I think, Adam.
I guess my concern is why all the pomp and circumstance if at the end of the day they can go back to their constituents, you know, if these are Tea Party people, conservatives, whatever, and just say, well, we defunded it, instead of all the where we're feeling the job killing. Healthcare bill.
Well, this is political grandstanding, pure and simple. They need to be able to go back and say, see, we went forward on our pledge. You know, we ran a 48-page piece of propaganda with 27 pages worth of pictures. We put that out there with a nice flowery language. How we were gonna do away with Obamacare, and those Democrats stopped us. They're just positioning themselves for the next election. And that's the thing I've always said about them. They're very good at running campaigns. They're very good at running for office. As we saw today, no ideas. All they talked about was destroying something that is very good for people with no idea on how to change it. You know how many times I heard we need to lower cost and improve access without any suggestions on how to do that? It had to be at least 100 times, Adam.
Yeah, it's typical.
Yeah, but again, they're excellent at the running. They're running the campaigns, throwing out the slogans, speaking their talking points, their platitudes. But when it comes to governing, not so much. What have they done to this point? I would argue they've got us into this mess. It's the whole deregulation of the health insurance industry that put us in this mess to begin with. I appreciate the call, buddy. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Speaker.
You know, and you go back and you look at how the health care, as I remember it as a kid, they were community hospitals. Community general, you know, such and such a city, community general, owned by the community, funded by the taxpayers. Not a for-profit interest. It was in the best interest of society to have this place where people go when they're sick. But then they saw how much profit could be made. And then they saw, you know, hey, insurance, it's a good way to skim off the top. That's a way to, you know, to take wages from workers. And then we saw rates going up and up and up and up. You know, my first memory of a doctor, I remember Dr. Motlack. Had a little office near the hospital. A nice guy, drove an old beat-up car, lived in that neighborhood, walked to work most of the time, didn't live in a big mansion, didn't make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, probably the best doctor I ever had. He went in there and, you know, oh, yeah, here's your problem. That's changed. We've made, and look, I'm not begrudging doctors of a living, but, you know, Dr. Bill Frist, should he be worth $10 billion? I don't know. What we've done is we've made this industry for profit, so my being sick is someone else's gain. That's not the kind of system I think is going to benefit us in the long run. Because right now there's no incentive to keep people from getting sick. There's no incentive, for instance, you know, I know a guy who's a very, very large individual. He's probably about 500 pounds. And he wants to have one of the gastric bypass surgeries because down the road, he knows he's going to need both hips and both knees replaced. And he knows he's going to have diabetes, and he knows he's going to have all of the very negative effects. And no matter how hard he tries, and look, you know, you can say whatever you want about personal responsibility, the reality is he's never going to be able to lose the weight. He's just not. He has a sedentary lifestyle. You know, he's on his behind 14 hours a day working. It's just not going to happen. So the reality is he's going to need something to help jumpstart it. So for the investment of, you know, $10,000, $12,000 in this surgery, could save both hips, could save both knees, could save a lifetime of diabetes, sleep apnea, all of the heart attacks, all of the negative effects by this one surgery. Insurance company won't pay for it. It's that kind of, you know, prevention. Look, you can say about personal responsibility all you want. The realities are what they are. When he needs a hip replacement, that's about $25,000. When he needs two, that's about $50,000. You start throwing in the knees, those are about $20,000 apiece. Now you're looking at $90,000 just in swapping parts. Throw in a heart attack, a bypass surgery, another $100,000. This stuff starts adding up. All that's something that could have been prevented. Somewhere at the beginning. Yearly checkups. Have your blood tested. Maybe you catch cancer early to where you don't have to go slash and burn. It's all about priorities. And as we move forward in this discussion about health care, and there's part of me, like Mark said, that's glad that the Republicans brought this up. There's part of me that's glad they made a spectacle of themselves today. And really in a bad light. They brought nothing new to the table. They spent a day and a half saying nothing new. It was like they were campaigning for votes to repeal it. And as we're seeing, the polls are going the other way. So when they say the American people have spoken, well, have they? Because as Mark Steer said, the more we're finding out about it, the more we're going, hey, that's not a bad idea. How many people before this healthcare discussion knew what rescission was? I got to be honest, I didn't. I didn't know they could go 40 years into my past and find that my mother gave me some kind of thing when I was 3 years old that causes cancer, and now that I get cancer, I'm not covered.
because I didn't report it? Did you know that? I didn't. And that this bill does away with that. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. Back after this. Drowning in crafty lies. Save the USA and resume the savage mind. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job, join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Auto Workers helped announce Tuesday that Ford is investing $400 million in its Kansas City assembly plant over the next 2 years. That factory will produce a new line of next-generation vehicles. It currently produces the Ford F-150 pickup and Ford Escape. The UAW says the investment will secure thousands of direct and supporting jobs in the Kansas City area. UAW Vice President Jimmy Settles says the union is pleased to have the cooperation of labor, business, and government working together to retain good jobs in Missouri. UE's Chris Townsend says workers at the Taunton, Massachusetts Esterline Technologies Haskin plant are considering an improved severance offer. The UE Local 204 Executive Board is recommending the workers accept the deal, and they'll vote on it later this week. So the planned action to try and stop an auction of the plant's equipment Wednesday has been called off.
I'll never second-guess our local members. I think that they battled this thing out to the 25th hour, did the very best they could with all of the heavy artillery pointed at them. For anyone even imagining what it might be like to be in the shoes of somebody in this situation, some folks presumably who are listening have been through this, is that there's an absolutely natural, reasonable tendency to look a little more fondly on the bird in the hand as opposed to the very sketchy or promissory bird in the bush.
Minneapolis Jimmy John's workers will get another chance at electing to join the IWW after losing by just 2 votes in an election nullified because the company violated labor law. Jesse Russell reports.
An attempt to organize nearly 200 workers for Jimmy John's sandwich shops in Minneapolis has been anything but freakishly fast. The Industrial Workers of the World won the right for a union election on October 22nd. And lost by a vote of 87-85. However, the IWW alleged to the National Labor Relations Board that the company had engaged in unlawful union busing tactics. The union alleged that Jimmy John's threatened to freeze wages and to retaliate against union supporters. On January 10th, the NLRB ruled in favor of the union and nullified the election. After 60 days, the IWW will be allowed to file for a new election. As the union works toward a new election, workers are asking the company's owners to take a look at what they call the 10-point program for justice at Jimmy John's. The plan includes time and a half for working between midnight and 6 a.m., one paid sick day per month, maternity and paternity leave, half-hour lunch breaks when more than 6 hours are worked at a time, and other demands.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a living, rich and prosperous. Father, son, left a cameo, blue denim, head as vain.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you want to email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Our Borowitz report for the day. In a moving White House ceremony today, President Hu Jintao of China presented U.S. President Barack Obama with a counterfeit DVD of the Hollywood blockbuster Toy Story 3. Mr. Hu raised eyebrows at several points of his official speech, especially when he repeatedly addressed the American people as my subjects. but the Chinese president ended his speech on an upbeat note about the relationship between the two countries, saying, in conclusion, America owes me the first month's rent and the security deposit. Speaking at a press conference, Mr. Hugh noted the historic nature of his meeting with President Barack Obama, saying, quote, it was the first time I'd met a Nobel Prize winner who wasn't in prison. Mr. Obama told reporters that he had hoped to speak to Mr. Hugh about China's human rights record, but said, to be honest, we've got as much leverage with China as a guy who's 3 months late on his car payment with the repo man. Meanwhile, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg took advantage of Mr. Hugh being out of the country to friend 1.3 billion Chinese. So there you go, our Borowitz report. And, you know, the thing is you've got the Chinese president here in the U.S., and we're doing the whole pomp and circumstance. We're doing the whole black tie and fancy dress occasion stuff. But the reality is we're not in the strongest of bargaining positions. We have lost numerous industries. And, you know, like we talked earlier with the woman who's house was drywalled with Chinese drywall, and she had to move out because it's making people sick. All of these products that we use, that we used to make, gone, all made there. And it's not that they made the better widget. It's not that they had the better innovation. It's that we allowed the corporations that we promoted to go. And then we allowed them to bring their products back. And we didn't say anything about it. The New York Times had a piece today that I thought was interesting, talking about the U.S. pressing China to get into their market. Because we're kind of blind. They've been using prison labor. They've been using cheap labor. They've been destroying the environment. That's okay over there. They've been stealing copyrights, they've been stealing intellectual property, and that's okay. They've been undervaluing their currency, some reports as high as 40%. That's okay. They've been demanding that they've been promoting Chinese companies, having bio-Chinese provisions, and that's okay. When are we going to wake up to all of this? When are we going to wake up to the fact that We don't have an equal relationship here? And in the article they write, the American companies have always had a love-hate relationship with China. With the manufacturing companies in the South, the steel companies in the Midwest, urging the government to take tough action against China, and advanced manufacturers and high-tech companies that want access to Chinese marketplaces, pressing for more conciliatory tone. So what you've got here in this country is we're fighting against ourselves even before we get there. And I've said that before. What we've got are 50 individual countries going after their own special interest even before we get to the Chinese. And what the article goes on to say, now both sides seem to want the administration to get tough because, duh, you got swindled. Last year, Jeffrey Immelt, the guy who said, you know, the future of GE is China, China, China. He was in a meeting in Rome with other business leaders, whining about the fact that the Chinese are protecting their national companies. Well, duh. What do you expect them to do? Google last March moved its Chinese service out of the mainland China. Why? Avoiding censorship. The American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing complaining that their members are finding increasingly difficult regulatory environment and that the Chinese companies are getting off pretty much scot-free. Why? Stop and think about it. They're benefiting themselves. So you got Treasury Secretary Geithner saying, well, what we need to do is we need to push for more market access. You know, make the Chinese open their markets to us. Do you really think they're going to open their markets to us when they've got us by the short hairs? And they know they do, not just because they've lent us some money, but because they manufacture everything. Now look, they need us too, but if they said, you know what, no more cheap goods for you. Nothing's made here anymore. The article goes on to say American multinational corporations, experts said, are hurt by Chinese regulations that openly favor Chinese companies over foreign ones for government contracts. These rules, which are intended to stimulate technological innovation in China, have the effect of cutting American and non-Chinese companies out of the big contracts there. You know, there's part of me that thinks we're the only country dumb enough to say, oh, yeah, come on in. Do our work for us. We'll pay you with our tax dollars, and we're going to freeze out our companies. I mean, we're the ones that need to have our heads examined. Somehow, we're the ones who've bought into this ridiculous notion that we need to have competition with people who are going to do everything they can possibly do to slit our throats. I'm not feeling it. You know what I see the Chinese doing? Smart things. I think the Chinese are smart. I see smart policy. Maybe instead of whining about, oh, we need more access. Maybe instead of saying, oh, they're devaluing their currency. Maybe we should say, you know what we're going to do? No more trading with you. You come up to our standards. You pay a living wage. You stop screwing up the environment. You start honoring intellectual property. And maybe we'll do some business with you. You know, we've bought into a sucker's game. We've bought into a sucker's game that we can't win. The question is not if we can win. It's how much are we going to lose? How much are we going to lose by this? And I'm saying we're going to lose a lot, and we're going to continue to lose a lot. We've lost millions of jobs. We've lost thousands of industries. Last time I saw the last report, 44,000 businesses that employed more than 500 people apiece have closed. And those jobs went somewhere. Where'd they go? China. You know, and early on we talked about the currency. When China decides they want to go with the Russians and do business with Russia in their currency, and the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China decide, you know what? We're going to create our own universal currency. We're the ones who get left out. But we're not seeing that far ahead. And look, I'm all for fair trade policies. I'm all for lifting all boats. I'm all for the Chinese workers being able to consume the products that they're producing. And this is the kind of stuff that I'm sure President Obama's bringing it up, but to be honest, he's not in a position of power. He's not going to be able to tell them what to do. Why? Because they're holding the cards. They've got the manufacturing power. They're the ones who are investing in their own infrastructure. They're the ones who are investing in the energy-producing modes of the future. Not us. You know, I was watching something on C-SPAN the other night where they were talking about the investment the Chinese government is making in wind and solar, and how it is just so far ahead of what we're doing. Technology that we invented is being perfected elsewhere and being put to work elsewhere because we don't have the vision. We don't have the leadership. And we have right now, what is a broken political system, because you have a party that is constantly running for office. And today, this healthcare thing just put another nail in that coffin for me. They're constantly in campaign mode. Today and last night, all it was one big campaign commercial. That's it. The job-killing socialist Obamacare bill. You know, they tried to tone it down. You know, because of the shootings. They did. They tried. And they started off, well, you know, the job destroying, the job killing, I mean. It's just in their blood. But you look at this relationship we have with China. And we talked about GE last night, transferring technology. You've got all these companies here in the U.S. who are now tech companies. The jobs that were supposed to be the ones that were created for the future. You remember in the 80s and 90s when we were losing the steel mills and all of the manufacturing plants of that era? Remember we were losing those, and you got people to get job training and unemployment under the trade loss bill that they passed, where if you lost a job due to one of the trade policies, you were able to go back to school for 2 years, and they pay unemployment and pay your education so that you get job training. And we trained all these people to work on computers. We had tons of people who were going to IT. I'm going to be a computer programmer. And for a short period of time, they did. I still remember the guy I met in New Jersey. We used to see him every morning on his way to work. I'd stop into the quick check for a quick break, and he'd be there getting his coffee, and we'd sit and talk. Him in his big suit and tie, driving his Cadillac, making six figures a year, working for Lucent Technologies. And he had the world by the short hairs. Making six figures, had high six figures in his 401k. And then I didn't see him for a while. One morning I happened to stop into a diner, and there he was, disheveled, unshaven. I said, "Man, well, I haven't seen you in a while. How you been?" Well, it turned out they shipped his job to India. And to add insult to injury, he actually trained his replacement and boxed up his own computer so that he could get his severance package. And that 401k that was high six figures was mid five figures because it was mostly tied to Lucent stock, which had gone from $100 a share down to $2. We gave those jobs away too. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
By gollies, America is still an exporting powerhouse. In fact, our corporate chieftains have made us number one in exporting America's most precious goods. Our jobs, factories, technologies, and middle-class opportunities. With unemployment and underemployment devastating millions of families in our country, perhaps you've assumed that U.S. corporations aren't hiring these days. Nonsense. They added 1.4 million jobs last year alone, overseas. For example, more than half of Caterpillar's new hires in 2010 were in foreign countries. Many more of this giant's jobs are headed offshore in the near future, for Caterpillar, which was once an iconic American brand, has recently invested in three new plants in China. It'll not only manufacture tractors and bulldozers there, but it'll also begin to ship its design work and technology development jobs to China. Likewise, DuPont, once proud of its U.S. workforce, has slashed its number of American employees in recent years while increasing its Asia-Pacific workforce by more than half. Indeed, DuPont no longer considers itself American. "We're a global player," sniffs its chief innovation officer. Such homemade brands as Coca-Cola, Dell, and IBM are also among the multitude of corporations abandoning our shores and our middle class. Of course, they still keep their well-appointed headquarters here so the corporation and top executives can continue enjoying all that America has to offer. Calvin Coolidge once asserted that what's good for business is good for America. That was myopic enough, but today's narcissistic CEOs are even more self-serving, declaring that what's good for business is good for business. America be damned. This is Jim Hightower saying, if we're to have a united society, America cannot tolerate such raw selfishness by the privileged few. We can have a plutocracy or a democracy, but not both.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. 7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, after the elections, the Tea Party was, you know, they were just, everybody thought, oh, the Tea Party, they're the movement of the future. We love the Tea Party. Everybody was thrilled about the Tea Party. But according to a new Washington Post ABC poll, 52% of the U.S. public now has an unfavorable view of the Tea Party, as opposed to 35%, the 35% who now approve. I mean, think about that. It's pretty amazing. Nearly three-quarters of Democrats, including many moderate and conservative Democrats, have negative views of the Tea Party. The same poll conducted back in September found 45% disapproval of the movement, while 36% supported it. Last March, its favorable rating exceeded its negative by a 41-39. So what we're seeing, you know, we're seeing people like Sarah Palin who have really said some pretty dumb things. You know, she came out the other day and said, I'm just not going to sit down and shut up. I go, okay, then just don't sit down. But what we're seeing is we're seeing all this craziness, and finally the media is picking up on it, I think. I think, you know, now the newness, the luster has worn off. That new movement smell is gone, and now we're getting a good whiff of what they're really about. So it's going to be interesting to see, and especially, and look, they're icons, the Tea Party movement's icons that have won in the last election. They haven't begun to fall yet. You haven't begun to see the stories that are coming, and they are, of how these guys are taking, you know, big corporate money, how these guys are taking lobbyist money, how they're falling from grace. And, you know, what I'm going to be interested to see is they all ran on this platform here in Pennsylvania as well. Everybody that you talk to said, oh, we need to cut spending. Oh, we need smaller government. Oh, we need deep, deep cuts. No more tax increases. You saw it on the federal level. You saw it here on the state level. And what I'm hearing is that the people who are on Corbett's transition team, who we haven't heard from yet, which is kind of weird, they're not finding, you know, maybe they didn't get the map. Maybe they didn't get the diagram to the Capitol that had the, you know, the dotted line to the Office of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse. Maybe they didn't get their map yet. You know, the one that has the big giant fire pit in the middle of the floor where we just throw all our tax dollars and you know, they cook weenies over it and marshmallows, all the state workers, all those rich state workers with the health care. Yeah, because, you know, they might burn their finger cooking the marshmallows, right? Isn't that what they're telling us? They're burning our tax dollars to cook their lunch? It's going to be interesting to see if you remember the Grand Pledge. You know, the GOP manifesto, the 48 pages of 27 pages of pictures, 21 pages of really, honestly and truthfully, flowery words, and a lot of repetition, a lot of redundancy. So to me, you know, I look at that document and I go, you know, if you wanted to do away with waste, fraud, and abuse, if you wanted to do away with redundancy, do with the document. You could have put that entire pledge on one page. Because that was the extent of their ideas. One page. And they weren't even good ideas. They were just retreads of the past that have failed. But if you look at what's coming and understand, they're talking about cutting massive across the board cuts. They want, you know, they've already compromised on the $100 million that they were going to cut. Because they realized, oops, not going to be able to do it. So they've come down and said, well, we're going to cut half of that, $50 billion. So the question is, when they start getting out the hatchet and they start cutting, oh, I don't know, $1 out of every $6 spent by agencies like the IRS, like the FBI, like NASA, like the Park Service, laying off government workers, what's that going to do? You know, their grand pledge, their big manifesto, we're going to cut $100 billion. And they're going to do it in 9 appropriation bills. Talking about an average of 18% across the board cuts. And you go through and you say, okay, well, let's talk about what you want to cut. And they come up with really dumb things like, oh, we're going to cut federal funding for Amtrak, 0.002% of the budget. Well, that's going to get you there. Nothing substantial. And look, if it's willful, I'd like to see it cut. I'm like anybody else. I want my money spent in the best way possible. And are there things that could be done better? I'm sure there probably are. Well, I don't know that you're going to get 18%. So, you look at Republicans in places like Minnesota, Wisconsin, the Dakotas. They're going to be hit hard. Maybe even here in Pennsylvania. They're going to be hit hard. Because the federal government is cutting their funding to LIHEAP. So it's going to fall on the backs of the states. And it's a pretty big cut. So what are they going to do when their constituents say, you know what, we need you to increase that spending, to take care of the folks who are going to freeze to death in the winter? What are you going to say to the people in Texas and Florida and Alabama when NASA cuts 8% of its budget, cutting thousands of jobs in those states? What are you going to say to them? What are you going to say to the 20% cut in subsidies that go to smaller airlines that provide service to smaller cities and towns? What are you going to say to that? You're going to say, oh, free market, baby, which means start walking. What are you going to do when the local school districts start feeling the squeeze because they're not getting the money from the federal government? Because the states have walked away from education years ago, especially here in Pennsylvania. They used to fund in the 50% range from what last time I heard, low 30s. So again, that's rolled downhill. Where? On the backs of the local taxpayers. They're talking about cutting special education grants to states by $1.4 billion, 11%. So what's going to happen? You're either going to cut services or you're going to raise taxes. And if you cut services, what does that mean? What does that mean for the community? What does that mean for the people in the schools? The other part of this, you know, they're gonna WIC, the Women's, Infants, and Children's Program. Again, another one of these big dumb decisions. Now, I'm sure some conservatives will be thrilled to hear that they're going to cut the salaries of the Food and Drug Administration. There's a beautiful idea. They're going to get $1 billion by cutting 35% of the FDA's budget. What does that mean for us? Does it mean all the stuff that's coming in from China is going to be looked at? I don't know. Pell Grants, all those students who are going to school on Pell Grants. Cutting them more than $1,000. So that means another $1,000 in student loans kids are going to have to take out in an environment where tuition's skyrocketing out of control. And you go down the list, Section 8 housing, they're cutting Section 8 vouchers, all for school vouchers, because there's some profit to be made there, but vouchers for poor people to find places to live? No, can't have that. No. We don't want those kind of vouchers, because we don't want those kind of people. Which leads me back to the school voucher issue. Do you think they're going to let those kind of people into their schools? I don't think so. And, you know, I got a lot of friends who go, well, you know, it's not me. You think? They think they're going to let you in? You're one of those people. You're one of those working people. You know, it's easy to divide ourselves. It's easy to slice and dice and say, I'm better than that guy and that guy. But the more we do that, the more we slice and dice, the more divided we become. And the harder it is for us to fight these powers. And you just look at the long list of cuts. Social Security, possibly going to be one of them. And when the president gives his State of the Union address, which is coming up, I think, on the 25th, is he going to talk about? Is he going to talk about Social Security? Is he going to talk about raising the retirement age, cutting some of the benefits? I sure hope not. Because for me, you know, in looking at this Social Security issue, That should be the last place we look. You want to start somewhere? I got a great place to start. A great place to start is to ask the people who have the resource, that top one-tenth of 1% who own 35% of this nation, to contribute a little bit. I don't even want to tax them. Just please contribute. You know, we'll use the Corbett frame. Because, and until we do all that, don't ask me to do any more, because I think we in the working class have done enough. I think we have struggled enough. I think we have given up enough wages. I think we have struggled with our families for long enough. You know, going back to education. You know, you go back to the time when one parent had to work and one could stay home to be with the kids. That was the ideal time. Now what happens, you got two parents working. They have no time to take care of the kids. They have no time to check and make sure the homework is done. They just don't have the time. And again, for me, all of our problems could be solved with a jobs bill. And this is why, and I've said it before, when the stimulus came out, I said we should have been spending more money on jobs. No more tax cuts, no more tax breaks for wealthy people. Jobs plan. When they wanted to extend the unemployment beyond the first extension, you know, there were the 26 weeks and then they had the first extension. Once that second extension came up, stop that. Put people back to work. Even if it's the federal government who has to do it. Even if the government is employer of last resort. Get people back to work. Because, you know, as I've always said, there are therapeutic qualities to work. There's that self-worth. That reason you wake up. And what frightens me and what worries me is that now you've created a class of people who, you know, they're looking and they're just not finding. And they're going to lose that work ethic. That's what worries me. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. You can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. Federal grand jury indicted Jared Loughner today in the shooting there in Arizona. The indictment accuses him of attempting to assassinate Representative Giffords and trying to kill two of her aides. This is a federal grand jury indictment, mind you. The state one is still pending. And I'm sure there will be state charges. And I'm not sure. I would probably bet my last dollar, if I were a gambling man, that Arizona has the death penalty. And it would be hard. It would really be hard for me to make a case against this guy going down. And understand, I'm not somebody who's in favor of the death penalty personally. I understand it. But I don't know. Maybe it's that bizarre Catholic upbringing of mine. That I just don't believe, thou shalt not kill, which is kind of weird, given my abortion stance. That's not my call either. That's my libertarian part of me. So it's kind of weird. But this guy, I don't know. I can't make an argument against it. Amazing, amazing stuff as far as I'm concerned. But, again, this is not something that I think as a nation we should be doing. But we'll see what happens. Also, today, President Obama made light of speculation that his ambassador to China, a guy named John Huntsman, he was former Republican governor of Utah, might run against him in 2012. And he made a joke, and you got to give Obama credit. He's got a good sense of humor. He said, quote, "I'm sure that him having worked so well with me will be a great asset in any Republican primary." Huntsman is considered a moderate Republican. And, there's been talk of him running for the White House. And he joined Obama in 2009 as part of the envoy to Beijing. So I was thinking about that. I was going, maybe that's the plan. Maybe Obama's going to run as a Republican. It's been seeming that way lately. Some of the things, the talking points that have been coming out, kind of makes you wonder. And speaking about abortion, I hate talking about those kind of issues because they are so divisive. And to me, honestly and truthfully, it's not my issue. I believe as a male, I'm never going to make the decision to have an abortion. I hope my children never have to. I hope my daughters never have to be in that position. But if they do, I want it to be safe. I want it to be legal. Because I remember my mother telling me stories about friends of hers who passed away due to backroom botched abortions. Personally, I'm not in favor of it. But, the libertarian part of me says that I really don't have the right to tell you what to do. But I look at this story out of Philadelphia, and I am outraged. This Dr. Kermit Gosnell. He ran what has been described as a filthy, foul-smelling house of horrors that was overlooked by regulators. He was charged today with murder, accused of delivering 7 babies alive and then using scissors to kill them. This guy, there should be a special room for. Now, understand, this is going to turn into an anti-abortion issue. You know it's going to. This is not about the abortion issue. This is some guy going off on his own with people who are poor, with people who are desperate. And this is what happens when you don't have proper oversight. This is what happens when you don't have regulators overseeing things. This is when you have a medical society that's not taking care of their own. And this guy, 69 years old, he deserves to spend every last moment of the rest of his life, if he is actually guilty of what they're claiming he is guilty of, in a very small cell. When they went into this place, he wasn't the only one charged. They charged his wife and several other employees, 9 employees, including his wife, who evidently none of them had medical backgrounds. In fact, the wife was a cosmetologist. You figure that out. But they went into this place and they found pieces
of fetuses in jars all around the office. They found cat urine and feces all over the place because the cats had the free roam of the place. And, you know, my first thought is, you know, why would you go to this? Who would, in their right mind would go to this? How desperate do you have to be? So this is what Corbett got thrown on his doorstep day one. How's he going to deal with this? You know, how are you going to go and say, well, we're going to have an administration that regulates and oversees and inspects. In fact, his spokesman, Kevin Harley, says, what needs to be done is regulators, whether on the local or state or federal level, need to properly regulate, inspect, and do their jobs. The safety of our citizens should be first and foremost. How are you going to do that when you're talking about massive, across-the-board, painful cuts? And look, this guy, and this guy, and I'm not saying he's the only one. I'm sure there are other folks out there. This guy needs to find out. There needs to be a special room for him because this is horrible. This isn't about abortion. And sadly, it's going to turn into that kind of an issue. But it's not about that. This is about a bad doctor. This is about a guy who, and you go into the rest of the details, a couple of women died because of his abuse. I mean, it's a horrible tragedy. But unfortunately, this is what happens to poor people when you don't have access to quality health care. This is what happens to folks when you don't have the money to go to the clinic down the road, the regulated hospital. When you've got to go to some back room. Yeah, they tell the story of the one woman who passed away in the waiting room because she was on painkillers. Is that the kind of society we want to move to? And look, I don't want to make this about abortion. I think this is the wrong message for this particular story, but you know the people are going to take it. You know this is where it's going to go to. And this isn't about that. But if we have to, is this the kind of guy we want our daughters going to in their hour of despair? Because I got to be honest, I could easily be anti-abortion. I could be one of the people who say, you know what, no more. Make it illegal. Other than the fact that I've got two daughters. I don't know what their future holds for them. I pray that they never find themselves in that situation. And I hope they make the right choices. But sometimes they don't. And I want them to be safe. And I don't want them to go to someone like this. And I think that's a place where I hope we can find some kind of common ground. You know, I hope. Because at the end of this, if we can't find some common ground on that, I don't know where we can. In other news, Joe Lieberman announced he is not going to seek re-election, so good riddance, Trader Joe. Also, Kent Conrad said he's not going to seek re-election in 2012. So, you know, Conrad's, you know, a middle of the road guy, but he is not going to seek re-election. The guy in Alabama that we talked about last night, remember him? This Robert Bentley, the new governor down there, who told his crowd of supporters that only people who love Jesus are my brothers and sisters, none of you other people. Well, he apologized, and what did you expect? But you know, you stop and you think about it. Kind of weird that this is the guy who's going to be leading the state. Anyway, in search of themes for his State of the Union address on January 25th, President Obama held a series of meetings last month with his economic team, outside economists, labor leaders, and business CEOs to find both a short-term patch and a durable system with a stronger set of rules to improve the economy. Frustrated by failure to define the depth and solutions to the economic recession, Obama will explain his new approach. Oh, boy, I can't wait. and focus on jobs and competitiveness during his address. Again, I'm hoping he leaves Social Security out of this. But like we talked about last night, I'm not thrilled. I don't know that I'm going to be really thrilled when I hear his new approach. Not overly thrilled. And we will see how this goes. And it's just amazing stuff. I'm almost at a loss for words. You know, when you look at that op-ed he wrote yesterday, I am almost at a loss for words because it's the antithesis of what he ran on. He ran on promoting workers. He ran on promoting corporate responsibility. He ran on doing those things. This is basically right-wing talking points. Okay, we learned our lesson from doing that other stuff. Okay, I've got the Kool-Aid. No new regulations. Got it. But that saccharin thing, boy, I'm still flipping mad about that because it kind of treats me like an idiot. And I don't know. So I can't wait to see the State of the Union address. I can't wait to see where the next year is going to take us. Should be very interesting. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717-232-7093 or visit our website at www.ibewlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
Always by your side.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
That's always the hope. And I
know some of my Tea Party friends are starting to think, well, gee, I think we got fooled here. Some of the Fox News people are not too happy. A new public policy polling survey found that fake news on Fox has fallen from its perch as the most trusted news network. 42% say they trust the fake news on Fox Network, down from 49% a year ago. Now you've got 46% of the people saying that they are not trustworthy, and that is up from 37% a year ago. So that's kind of going in the other direction. Who has moved into the top perch? Who has taken that coveted, most trusted news network position? PBS. 50% of the folks said that they trust the news that they get from PBS, while 30% claimed they did not. Personally, I trust C-SPAN. I like to see what's going on with my own two eyes. But speaking of TV, you may be happy to know that, you know, again, won't get fooled again. The FCC has given the green light to Comcast, so the merger with NBC Universal appears to be going, you know, full speed ahead. The only dissenting vote came from Democratic Commissioner Michael Copps in the 4-1 vote, giving NBC Universal the ability to be taken over. And Copps said that he thought that the merger confers too much power in one company's hands. And I agree with that. You know, you look at this merger, this is a mega, mega merger. This is really opening the door to cableize the open internet. The potential is really dangerous. And I can't believe, again, that they would allow this to happen. But, again, corporate money talks. So you go, well, what's the big deal? What's the big deal if, you know, if they own, Comcast owns NBC Universal? What you're doing is you're consolidating the message. You're putting more control into the hands of one mega corporation. And as we've seen over the years, the media has been consolidating down and down and down. And programs like this one have almost an impossible opportunity to get out over the airwaves. Now, we have a pretty sizable internet listenership, and I appreciate all our folks who listen on the internet. We do a nice podcast as well, and thank you to the folks who download our podcast. We appreciate it, but we're a terrestrial program as well. Finding outlets to take our program is, to make it simple, is almost impossible. Because what you're seeing is you're seeing these corporations who own large amounts of stations, you know, Citadel, Clear Channel, Viacom, you know, right down the list, a handful of companies owning the mass of the media. Is that good for our democracy? And, you know, you look at the talking points that go out. I just got an email from this Red States website, you know, that said that, you know, get the newsletter that all the politicians and talk show hosts get. Which is why, you know, you listen to any of the right-wing talk show hosts, they all sound the same because they're reading off the same script. They're all controlled by corporate America. I mean, even this nitwit we've got here locally, who said we ought to blow up the New York Times. And I'm sure he said that 100 times before. It's just now, in light of the shooting, somebody's more sensitive to it. And I'll bet he'll say it 100 times more in the future. But just now, it got him a big story in the newspaper. And you know what that's going to do? It's going to make him bigger. I'll bet you he gets a syndication deal out of it. Is that right? It is what it is. And I look at this consolidation, this takeover, as a really, really bad thing to our democracy. And I blame Bill Clinton as well. I blame Reagan, but I blame Bill Clinton. The Telecom Bill of 96 was a horrible, horrible bill. But we had to do it because, you know, there's money to be made. And this takes me back to our discussion about campaign finance.
What we need to do is we need to get the big moneyed interests out of this. But I don't know that's going to happen. Some good news. Sarah Palin has hit an all-time low or high, depending on how you look at it. Her approval ratings are in the tank. So you can look at it as she's got an all-time low approval rating or an all-time high unfavorable rating, however you want to look at it. According to a CNN poll, 56% of the country expressed an unfavorable opinion with the former governor, the quitter there from Alaska, and reality TV star, even though she seems to think it's a documentary, which, again, you know, about an inch deep she is. Among women, Palin's unfavorable rating has increased by 10%, and it's gone up by a whopping 14% among independents. So the rising star is now, well, it's now falling. And that's okay because she's made her money. And that's what it was all about. You know, I love that whole, I'm quitting my job as governor so that the state can move forward. Really? Did anyone buy that? I didn't. What I bought is, you know, she's a gold digger. She saw an opportunity to make a bunch of money, have people write books for her that she can slap her name on and fill her pockets. And you know what? Who can blame her? But don't tell me she's going to be running for president and that, oh, she's a viable candidate when she calls that crummy TV show she does a documentary. Because it's not. The census had some information that I found particularly interesting. When you talk about, you know, stereotypes of the South, one doesn't think of gay people having a great presence there in the South. But according to some census data, gay people are raising children in the South more common than in any other region of the country. Gay couples in southern states like Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas are more likely to be raising children than their counterparts on the West Coast, in New York, and in New England. Think about this. Little Rock may be just as commonplace as parenting in Little Italy. Black and Latino gay couples are twice as likely as whites to be raising children. A large number of gay couples, possibly a majority, enter into current relationships after having children with their heterosexual partners. So the numbers are kind of interesting. I'm thinking Texas, really? So it's pretty, there are, according to the census, there are approximately 581,000 same-sex couples in the United States. So, wow. Yesterday, one of the federal regulations have come out on hospital visitations, and I think this is part of the health care bill. Now, new federal regulations on hospital visitations take effect to protect same-sex couples to visit people in hospitals across the country. Personally, I can't believe that you didn't have that right anyway. I'm surprised that you don't have to go the right to go in and see anybody in the hospital. But according to this, not so much. In the good state of Georgia, down in the South there, where evidently there are a large number of gay people. The National Alliance to End Homelessness released its annual report, The State of Homelessness in America, that sought to document the problems that afflicted our nation's homeless population. And one of the major findings of the report was that during the economic recession, the number of homeless people increased 3% or by about 20,000 people there in Georgia, and the number of homeless families increased 4%, with the state and municipal budgets continuing to be squeezed, the poor economy, much of the duty of caring for these people has fallen on private charities. So now you look at this group called the House of Mercy, where two women checked in with their kids. They're not allowing this lesbian couple to go into the House of Mercy. Amazing stuff. We'll see you tomorrow night. Have a great night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the good sway. Imperial and mysterious in amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and W.